Nature's Edge is brought to you by the Angler Magazine of Western North Carolina, Western North Carolina's only magazine dedicated to the fishing enthusiast. Pick one up at over 400 locations throughout Western North Carolina or visit them online at theanglermagazine.com to find out more. And be sure to follow them on Facebook, Angler Magazine of Western North Carolina.com.
Welcome to Nature's Edge. This is Dale Stewart, and I want to talk a little bit. I was in a discussion the other night with some young people, and we're going to talk about this with my in-studio guest today, but the question came up about the zoos and sort of what my thoughts were on zoos and game parks and nature centers and that sort of thing. And it was interesting to sort of listen to these young men and women. I guess you'd call them millennials. They were all college stage age, but they had some different ideas about wild animals in captivity, and they really were interested in my thoughts on that, and sort of what my feelings were about animals in captivity, and I told them I think that our nature parks and our zoos today play a very important role in the welfare of animals and in the education of people about animals and what's out there. And one of the young ladies that I was talking to there kind of looked over at me and she says, "Well, Dale, I just don't like the idea that they capture these wild animals and bring them and put them behind cages." And I said, "Well, young lady, and our guest can correct me on this, I said, it's been many, many decades since we captured wild animals and brought them and put them on display. We don't do that anymore." And she looked at me and she says, "You sure?" I said, "Yes, I'm 99% sure on that, and we'll get 100% sure here in just a minute on that episode." She said, "Well, that's a little different." And I said, "You have to understand, these animals that are in these areas now, and we don't really have cages too much anymore. Most of the wildlife centers, including the zoos and the nature centers, have gone to more natural type of habitats. It's better for the animals, and it's better for the people that come for the education process and to look at them." Excuse me, getting over a cold, and it's difficult sometimes, particularly when you've been talking nonstop for a couple of days like I have. But anyway. Our guest today is a friend of mine. He's also the director of the Western North Carolina Nature Center, Chris Gentle. And, Chris, welcome to Nature's Edge.
Oh, Dale, it's great to be back. And what a great segue. You opened up the show so well by talking about, you know, people and their misconceptions of zoos and wildlife centers and aquariums and things like that.
Yeah.
Now, I will tell you that there's good zoos and there's bad zoos.
Yes.
There's accredited zoos, like the Nature Center. Western North Carolina Nature Center is accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And of the 5,000 or so facilities in the United States that have licenses from the USDA to be able to exhibit animals, there's only about 220, 230 that actually are accredited by our organization. So basically what that means, Dale, and for your listeners, is that when you go to a facility like ours that has the AZA accreditation, and you'll usually see a display, a little sticker right when you go in, so you know it's a facility that's gotten accreditation. You're talking about facilities that have excellence contribute quite a bit to conservation, not only locally but in the wilds of some of the range countries where these exotic animals might live. But also excel in education programs and make sure that the programs that they offer connect back to what the schools might be learning, what the curriculum might be in the schools. So, yes, again, there are good zoos. And then, of course, there's zoos that maybe we don't think are that good. And a lot of folks have been to those not-so-good zoos and have gotten a misconception of the fact that there are some good ones out there and maybe never have gotten reconnected again.
Yeah, I think that's true. And am I correct that we don't capture wild animals?
You're absolutely right. You were 99% right, like you said. Most of the animals that you see in zoos, accredited zoos today, come from other zoos or were born in a zoological setting. Now, we do have some animals at the zoo that were nuisance animals that were injured in the wild.
Yes.
And, of course, they did live in the wild, but they either became too accustomed to people feeding them They were injured in the case of some of our birds of prey, and they couldn't live in the wild anymore. So then they came to a situation like the Nature Center where they could live. Almost like, I hate to say rehab, because that's not really, you know, exactly what we do, but it's a place where animals don't have to necessarily face the rigors of a wild life. And they couldn't because they have injuries that would prevent them from surviving in that situation. So
yeah, and I do, as you know, Chris, I've done a lot of work with different zoos around the country, particularly in the marketing and PR side of things. And and you're correct. I know it seems like I'm thinking back now, and I know quite a few zoos. And again, it seems that it's birds of prey that they wound up, a lot of them wind up getting for that reason.
Yeah, and Dale, I always love coming on your show because you know a lot about zoos, as you just mentioned, and you certainly understand and appreciate why it is we exist. I think as a zoo professional, somebody who's been in the business for 25 years, honestly, I wish there weren't zoos, because that means that animals in the wild would have all the things they need, and they wouldn't face pressures of population explosions or hunting or things like that. I think any zoo professional would tell you the exact same thing. We're not here to profit off these animals. Of course, the Nature Center is a government-owned entity. We're a not-for-profit, so it's not like we're making money off these animals. But what we're trying to do is connect people to the animals that live in our region, the Southern Appalachian Mountains, and let them know a little bit more about their natural history, what it takes to survive in a climate like this. And, of course, with this weekend coming up, we might have a pretty severe weather. So these animals have to be used to the heat and to the cold. But also what it takes to survive when their habitat continues to shrink.
Yeah.
So it's really a great opportunity for people to come and appreciate what we have in the Southern Appalachians, even though some of these animals you probably won't see when you visit our natural area.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I know a number of zoos. I mean, the I think the zoos around the world, in a lot of ways, some of the endangered species, some of the species that are right on the brink, zoos have been instrumental in actually helping reintroduce some of those animals back to the wild. So they've sort of reversed from taking animals out of the wild and putting them in zoos. Now some of the zoos are actually developing and have developed programs where they're moving animals back into the wild in some areas.
Well, and we could use a perfect example of a species here in North Carolina that's got a pretty high profile, and that's the red wolf.
Oh, yeah.
And recently, the state of North Carolina actually, there was a case where the U.S. Fish and Wildlife decided that they were going to give up on the red wolf program.
Yes. Yes.
Basically, and the only place that they live in the world in the wild is here in North Carolina on the eastern coast in near Manteo. There's Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge. That's where you find the 50 or less remaining wild red wolves in the United States, in the world. So recently a judge declared that was not going to happen. They weren't going to shut down the program. We were going to continue that wildlife facility that's out there, that protected area, so that these red wolves could potentially have a place to go. And what that means for us at the Nature Center, since we have red wolves in our collection,
yes,
is that if our pair were to produce offspring, and in the past we've had several offspring litters of red wolves produced, that they can potentially go back to this protected reserve and try to populate, become a wild species again in the wild. Of course, right now, the effort is very slow. And that
absolutely.
The court case that happened recently is going to help a little bit. And our wolves that we have here continue to produce offspring, but they go to other facilities to keep the captive or the zoological numbers up. There's about 250 red wolves zoo settings in the United States. That they're not in any other countries. And with only 50 left in the wild, you can see how important it is, if there ever is a place to reintroduce these animals, how important zoos are.
Several weeks ago, actually, I had been on Prater, and we talked at length about the red wolf. The Western North Carolina Nature Center, the animals that you have there, for the most part, all of them are indigenous at some point in time to Western North Carolina, correct?
That's right, yeah. And I know you're going to follow, we're going to follow this down the road as to an animal species that we're about to introduce here in the Nature Center in the next couple of months. But that's true. All the animals that you'll see at the Western North Carolina Nature Center, what makes us unique is they either still live or at one time lived in the Southern Appalachians, in the Western North Carolina region. So even though we may not have cougars anymore, of course, there may be individuals out there, but we don't have an active living population of animals that continue to breed. We also don't have gray wolf anymore in this area. Even though you may not see those animals anymore, they were here at one time.
Yeah.
So it gives you a chance to see what lives here now and what might have lived here at one time.
And speaking of that, you're about to introduce a species that most people probably would have never thought were at one point in time indigenous to the Southern Appalachian. And you want to tell us about that?
Oh, I'd love to, Dale. And it's a very exciting thing for us at the Nature Center because we're about to introduce to our visitors and to the Western North Carolina region red panda. And I remember way back when, as a matter of fact, a couple of years ago, I came on your show and we talked a lot about zoos, just like we're doing now. We always have a good back and forth on that. We talked a little bit about animals that we were hoping to introduce to the Nature Center. We even touched on red panda at the time. The thing about red panda that's very unusual is people don't realize that their closest ancestor lived in our region about 5 million years ago. Anybody that's ever gone over to the other side of the mountains in the Tri-City area, there's a wonderful little museum called the Gray Fossil Museum in Gray, Tennessee,
yes. Not
right near Johnson City.
Yeah.
And about 15 years ago now, when they were doing a highway project in the area where the Gray Fossil Museum is now located, as they were digging, they unearthed a fossil, several fossils actually, but a fossil that they couldn't recognize. They had no idea what this was. They hadn't seen anything like it. And the scientists from Eastern Tennessee State University came in and helped with the identification of what they were seeing. And finally, they deduced that this was a primitive red panda that had never been discovered before. The fossil that they discovered was from an animal that never existed or never was believed to be existing before. They dubbed this species Bristol's panda, not because it's near Bristol, Tennessee, Virginia, but it's the person who discovered it had the last name Bristol. And that animal, now that they've done more active digging at that site, they've unearthed 5 or 6 different remnants of these, showing 5 or 6 different individual animals of this Bristol's red panda. So believe it or not, at one time, the very close relative to the current red panda, which lives in Central Asia,
yes.
lived here in the Southern Appalachians. It was much more terrestrial, didn't climb as much as the red pandas that we see today. It was a little bit bigger, almost twice the size, but did in fact live here. So if you think about our region, and a lot of times people think about the flora and the fauna that we have here, we have a lot of flora that is very similar to Central Asia, where the red pandas live today, bamboos and rhododendrons and
yes.
things like that. So it's not out of the realm of possibility to think that an animal that lives in Central Asia now lived here at one time because they eat bamboo. They just ate our native bamboos that we have here.
Would you, for the listeners, describe a red panda? Because I know what they look like. And I've been fortunate that I've actually seen them in the wild.
Oh, that's incredible.
But they're not like the panda that most people think of when you mention the word panda.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of times people think panda and they think of the giant panda, the black and white panda that's WWF's logo,
right,
World Wildlife Fund's
right.
logo. But the name panda kind of means bamboo eater.
It does. Yeah.
So an animal that eats bamboo, like the red panda and the giant panda, have kind of gotten the same, even though they're not related. At one time, people thought red pandas and giant pandas were both members of the raccoon family. Of course, giant pandas are bears, just like black bears are. They're in that same family. And then red panda are in their own family,
yeah.
Even though they're very closely related to the current raccoon, the common raccoons that we have around here. But the name panda means bamboo eater.
Yeah.
And the thing that they both share, the giant panda, the Asian species that a lot of people maybe recognize right away, and the red panda is, even though the red panda is a lot smaller, they still have this very unusual bone in their wrist. And they call it the panda's thumb. It's not really a thumb like we as people have that we can use kind of opposable to our other four fingers, but it's a little bone that sticks out of their wrist. And when they curl the other four fingers around this bone, it helps them to grab. So imagine an animal that can grab, wrap those four fingers around, wrap it against this thumb, and they can pull bamboo out. And they can use it to hold on to bamboo while they eat it. And that's an adaptation that we've only seen in the giant panda and the red panda because of their proclivity to eat bamboo. It's an adaptation to help them.
I learned something there. I knew about that bone in the giant panda, but I did not know that the red panda as well had that.
It certainly does, and that's a good evidence that the animals both kind of evolved to eat a very unique thing, and that's bamboo. Now, a red panda is much smaller, only about maybe 10 to 20 pounds. The animals that we're getting are between 15 and 20 pounds at the Nature Center. And they're red, as you can imagine. They also sometimes call them fire fox.
Yes.
Because they almost look like a little fox, but very, very like a rustic red look. And they have a beautiful pattern on their face. They have a, you know, white and red and a little bit of black pattern on their face. And I think in terms of cuteness factor, of course, as a scientist, both of us, we don't really like to talk cute, but
yeah.
It is something that makes an animal much more charismatic. And red pandas are actually a species that has a very active conservation program to help protect their numbers in the wild. And that's something that we are going to actively participate in by contributing funds every year to help this animal in its native range.
Are you going to have a breeding pair or how many are you bringing
well,
in? Or?
Well, our goal, Dale, is to actually eventually get to the point where we could breed them. We're starting off with a pair that has bred. The female is now post-reproductive. She's going on 10 years old. And when you get to that point in red pandas, yes. they tend to stop breeding. So the pair we're going to have will not be a breeding pair. But they are going to be a pair that's been together. They're coming to us from Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago. They're a pair that has bred before, it knows each other very well. And Lincoln Park is working on a new exhibit there, so they need a place for their pair to go for a number of years while they work on that. Once that exhibit's done and they may potentially go back to Lincoln Park, then once we've gotten our expertise down in husbandry and our exhibit is, you know, we got our exhibit tweaked perfectly for their needs, then we can entertain the idea of bringing in a breeding pair. So our goal is to do that, and the facility that we've built is absolutely magnificent. It's got a beautiful indoor area which guests can see into the backup, so they can kind of see how modern zoos take care of animals. It's a great place to look at how we prepare their food, how we do our vet checkups, things like that. People can get this glimpse behind the scenes, but then it has about 8,000 cubic feet of space outside for the animals to climb.
Yeah.
So you're going to see these animals up in the trees, up in the structures that we're building for them. It's a very active species, and since their ancestors called the Southern Appalachians home at one time, you can imagine that they're going to feel right at home because where they live in Central Asia is very similar climate. It never gets super cold.
It is.
And it never gets super hot where they're from.
Yeah, I tell people that all the time. You know, I talk about the rhododendrons and there's actually some sites in Southern Appalachians that I can go and take a picture of, go into certain areas of Asia and take a picture, and they look very similar.
Exactly. Yeah. And what we think is really interesting about bringing the species in is not only is it an animal that has a very active conservation program, so we can get involved with something that other AZA-accredited zoos are involved with and actually help out with that program because we have the resources here in Asheville to be able to do that in Western North Carolina. But now we can teach people that come to the Nature Center about a whole different discipline of science, that being geology and animals that used to live here. And because our mountains are so old, there's so many secrets that are hidden within them, like this discovery of the Bristol's panda. So we're really excited about the opportunity to introduce people to a whole new branch of science when they visit the Nature Center. We have a model, a full-scale model that a company in Illinois built for us that looks exactly like what we believe the Bristol's panda looked like.
Oh, man.
We were able to take the folks from Eastern Tennessee University and the Gray Fossil Museum helped us out with some sizes of the bones that they've discovered. There's estimates of how big they were. And we sent these to these artists, and they crafted a full-scale model of what we believe this animal looked like. So people can compare that. And it's a one-of-a-kind. It's the only one of its kind in the world. They can compare that to what the current red panda looks like and see that they're walking in the area where these animals might have lived at one time.
That's when, Chris, will the public be able to?
Well, we expect our animals to be in soon, and then they'll have to go through quarantine.
Sure.
And then, of course, a quarantine doesn't mean like, you know, zombie apocalypse or anything like that. It's more just making sure that they're not, you know, susceptible to anything that's in their new exhibit. And then the new exterior exhibit is just about ready. So we'll expect to see them out walking around in the exhibit sometime in mid-February.
Good. I will be there. And
Oh, we'd love to have you.
Yeah. How many actual species does the Nature Center have now?
Right now we have, at last count, somewhere between 60 and 65. And it ebbs and flows because we bring in different insect species during different times of the year and things like that. But one of the things I think that's really exciting about the Nature Center, not only is it because we feature native wildlife, but because we give people a real taste of all the diversity of life that we have. We don't just feature the big mammals,
right?
The charismatic mammals, let's say, or the birds or things that people are used to seeing. You'll go into our Appalachian Stationery and see several different species of salamanders, many different species of turtles. things that we are, as a eco-region in the world, excel in. We have more salamanders, as you know, Dale, than any other place in the world, more salamander species. Mm-hmm. So we really want to show people the diversity of life that exists here in our mountains so that they can appreciate the fact that they're in a place where some of these animals, it's the only place they live.
Yeah. You have the hellbender.
Exactly. Yeah. And we have a wonderful exhibit for the largest salamander that lives in the United States. Yeah,
I know. And I'm excited about that. And something you don't know is I'm actually in the middle of getting ready to do a documentary on the hellbender. And I'm actually working with the Nashville Zoo.
Oh, my gosh. They're leaders in the – yep.
They really are. In fact, yeah. I was over there a few weeks ago with them and met their people and had a great three-day indoctrination on the hellbender and of course the stuff that the Defenders of Wildlife and Ben are doing here.
It's amazing. And hellbender. You know, and the Nashville Zoo, another AZA accredited zoo,
yes.
Excellent facility. If anybody gets to the center of Tennessee and has a chance to go to Nashville Zoo, you'll see some amazing things there.
Oh,
they've
absolutely.
Done an incredible job, their staff. But that's an animal, like we talked about before, that this is something that zoos can come together to help save. And we work with Hellbender, the North Carolina Zoo,
yes.
Nashville Zoo, Knoxville Zoo. There's several zoos within our ecoregion that kind of participate in this. So by the power of numbers, we're able to make more of a difference than, let's say, one little zoo out there working with a species that, you know, they're the only ones focusing their resources on. So.
Yeah, when the documentary is finished, we'll have to do a showing of it at the Nature Center.
Absolutely, Dale. And, you know, it's right in our wheelhouse, and we'd love to have you out. And one other thing, too, that if people haven't visited in a while, and I know, Dale, you've been very supportive of us. You've been out many times. And I remember you were our groundhog whisperer one year for Groundhog Day.
I was, and I was so sad. Didn't my groundhog pass
away? Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, groundhogs don't live very
long. They don't live that
long. But you did bring us six more weeks of winter, which I think a lot of people were disappointed with.
Yeah.
But the one thing I think that's really exciting about the Nature Center is not only the animals that we bring in, but we just opened an incredible new front entrance.
Yes.
And one of the things I think, you know, you think these facilities, oh, they're guest facilities, and we want to see the animals and things like that. But we had a lot of challenges at the Nature Center. First of all, we had very limited parking.
Yeah, you do.
But yet we still were seeing 130,000, 140,000 people a year. So people were really wanting to come to us. And they were even parking in areas that required them to walk hundreds of yards to get to us. So now with the new entrance, we have wonderful parking facilities. We have wonderful visitor amenities, like a great drop-off circle where, you know, somebody could pull up the car, drop off the family, then go park and, you know, make it much easier for entrance to the center. But also, it's a great opportunity for us to increase what we do for school-age children, because we now have a dedicated entrance in our old main building. It's now our education center, just for buses to pull. So if you were ever here on a busy day at the Nature Center, let's say a school vacation week, you know that we mixed guests with buses, and it was not a good mix. So now we've done what a lot of zoos do. Nashville Zoo just opened a new entrance as well, since we were just talking about them. We have now separated our school services area out from the general guests so that everybody can have equal enjoyment of the center, but not necessarily clog up the works when it comes to getting into the center.
And the new entrance and everything is open now, correct?
I mean, yes, sir. It opened back in September. And,
yeah, I was thinking.
We're very excited, and we wanted to open it during a time of year when we weren't as busy, so we can work all the kinks out so that when school vacation rolls around in March and April, we are ready to welcome our big throngs for the year.
Let's talk just briefly about education programs. I know you have schools that visit there and everything else, and of course, you know, education is a big factor with me. Speaking at schools and so forth, is that still a big part of the program at the Nature Center?
Yeah, absolutely.
Education?
Absolutely, Dale. And actually, one of the things that I think we're most proud of at the Nature Center, and certainly since we're a City of Asheville facility, City Council and our staff, city staff was absolutely overjoyed by this, is we recently won the AZA Education Award for the year. And it's a big achievement for a really relatively small facility when you're competing.
Sure.
Or not competing, we're collaborative. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But when you're up against, let's say, facilities like the Bronx Zoo and San Diego and, you know, Brookfield and some of these humongous zoological facilities. But our outreach program, which we started about 3 years ago now, has really revolutionized what we do education-wise, because there was a lot of school groups that could never get to us. Schools in Jackson County, Madison County, you know, it's hard for those schools to get to us. So now we offer the ability for us to go to them. It's not quite bringing everything out, but it is the opportunity for us to expand our reach. And because a lot of those counties don't have the same amenities, we can then be the ones that deliver some of their science, some of their science learning, and we're very proud of that.
Yeah. To wrap up, Chris, people want to volunteer or donate or something, they can go to your website.
Yeah, right? The website, absolutely, and it's wildwnc.org. And of course, we have a very good partnership with our friends at the Nature Center. They're our 501c3 support organization. So even though we're City of Asheville, we get a lot of our operation from the City of Asheville. We rely on the friends to help us raise money for things like the new entrance or the Red Panda exhibit or the some of the new things that are coming down the pike. Yeah. So that's how we've been able to grow.
Chris, again, as always, it's been a pleasure having you on Nature's Edge and learning a little bit about what's going on at the Nature Center. I look forward to getting out there and doing a remote broadcast actually at the center.
Oh, we'd love to have you, Dale. And thank you. It's my pleasure to come on, and we certainly value the interest that our guests have when they come to visit us, and we want to continue to increase their experience.
Thanks a lot. Guys, you've been listening to Nature's Edge, and we will see you in the wild.
Visit naturesedgemedia.com. You can check out podcasts, videos, lecture archives from Dale, and much more. Thank you for listening to Nature's Edge with Dale Stewart, brought to you by Angler Magazine of Western North Carolina.